Welcome to Conversations on Public Safety, The Den, a podcast that asks, are we ready to reset the landscape of public safety? Whether you're a veteran of criminal justice, a newcomer who wants to foster change for the next generation, or someone actively involved in the field grappling with the complexities of decision-making, you're invited to the conversation. In each episode, you'll hear from a panel of four highly respected criminal justice thought leaders for an unscripted, unedited, and vulnerable discussion about the future changes needed for policing. Together, they hold more than 100 years of experience and are using our insight to help evolve practices, policies, training, and community relationships. They're challenging themselves and you to get introspective and question the status quo. Let's dive into today's topic.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to yet another conversation in the Den. This is your host, Jessica. We're continuing our conversation about capacity and leadership from the last episode, where you heard us talk about the roles, activities, and responsibilities we think police should perhaps continue to maintain, and the option of having new entities or new roles within a police department to help. While criminologists have always thought about law enforcement or policing as a law enforcement entity, the reality is that the scope of policing includes various maintenance order or peacekeeping activities, the problem solver, and the community service officer. And so in this episode, we're going to reflect a little bit about Rodney and him papering Georgetown with tickets in his early years, where that measure got him rewarded and promoted for performance. But in this episode, we question whether that's still the same as expectations we should have, and really what should patrol and sworn officers should be doing on a day-to-day basis. For many of us on the panel here, we came down to the simple idea that if an officer needed to provide a level of protection to themselves or others during the job, that perhaps a sworn officer was needed, whether that was responding to traffic accidents and traffic zones or investigating other types of crimes. But even then, we didn't necessarily agree that role of a police officer to be in a position of power or have a gun or other weapons to detain were necessary for all types of roles and activities. So I look forward to your thoughts as you hear us discuss the roles of victim advocates and professional forensic interviewers, crime scene technicians, and even school resource officers, as whether or not they should be sworn or unsworn, or what are the types of training they should have. And if you're interested to know a little bit more about where we agreed and disagreed to all of those categories, please visit the show notes or our website for the PDF document of all those categories and where we were divided. And also see the survey that we've released to hear your opinions of whether or not a police officer should or should not be engaging in certain activities in the future of policing. We look forward to your thoughts.
It's kind of like restorative justice. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about restorative justice where go say you're sorry, or, you know, tell me you won't do that again. That's restorative justice. And the banks, they just say, well, give me my money back. Well, give me a percentage of my money back and I'll be okay. So I just don't think that we've taken on these roles and responsibilities over the years. And now most fraud is committed via the internet. Oh, yeah. And I consider banks and insurance companies like the FBI. They're everywhere. You know, police departments, you're police for Charlotte, North Carolina. I can't go into Maryland and say, police department, I want you to do X, Y, and Z. But Nationwide can contact investigators in New York or California or whatever. Bank of America can contact investigators all across the world and say, hey, investigate this and have better outcomes than any single police department could. They're national, international.
Yep. Hold on to those thoughts, because this kind of theme came up again for me when I was looking through our other responses of stuff, right?
Yeah. I'm just thinking through all that's here. And take out traffic reconstruction, the accident reconstruction, crash reconstruction, because that does take some time. And then if you took out the presidential visits for DigPro, okay, everything else on this list is about a mindset. In fact, I would challenge you to find any officer in any department anywhere in this country that would say, all I do is write tickets. And I do that 8 hours a day for my shift or 10 hours a day. Well, great. Let me see those 30 or 35 citations you wrote. What? What do you mean? I only wrote two. Well, how many cars did you stop? Well, I stopped three. What'd you do the rest of your time there, cowboy? Because what we have here is a mindset of we're too busy because we're doing this stuff. But at the end of the day, if you really start counting what you've got and what you do, as with most things, this is small potatoes. You know, crash reconstruction is when somebody's dead. And so that is an investigative function. But everything else here, nobody's going out and scratching out 80 parking tickets in an 8-hour shift, which is about what you could do if you were working.
Back in the day now, you give me a ticket book, they had 60 tickets per book. On a Friday, Saturday night, I could go through two ticket books.
But what else did you do? That's what you did.
That was what I did.
And then how long did it take you to scratch one ticket out? Once you got good at it.
I sat in roll call and pre-filled out the ticket in roll call. So all I had to do was put a tag number in.
There you go. But see, that's smart working. That's working smart. I mean, you take time on the street to do that. He's knocking that stuff out.
Yeah.
But that's what he did on a Friday and Saturday night. That was his job. But who else was doing it in Georgetown? They couldn't because Rodney had it all. He was fishing that hole out.
You ever been to Georgetown? You can write 1,000 tickets a day.
Oh, yeah.
You can write 1,000 tickets a day, bro. You're ruthless, too. Ruthless.
Ruthless.
Buddy. The other part, and I'm going to come back to this point later, because I think this is where, like, right, the police one survey, which I just always shake my head when people are, you know, one, not only doing the survey, but two, like, then want to share it out as if it's like, oh, so factual, is that, like, you have this resource that police constantly go to for blogs, there are police chiefs writing to it and everything else, and they're putting out this information saying, hey, 87% of our constituents don't want to give up this type of, you know, and that's a bit of a false percentage point, of course, but it does create this mindset of like, you can't take this away from me, because of course, while they're maybe not papering the town like Rodney used to, that it's the like, well, what else would they be doing, right? Or maybe you do have one or two motors specific people that really are out there, you know, writing tickets in a specific area or at an intersection, but the other three or four, five folks that are on the squad aren't doing that same thing. So somebody's carrying the weight. I think this is where some of the data analysis kind of helps people understand, like, do I got one person writing a bunch of tickets, or do all 10 people on the squad actually respond to these things and do this? So,
you know, Jessica, if I don't need a gun and a badge to do a job, somebody else can do it.
Correct.
Sure. You know, if I don't have to lock somebody up or physically restrain someone, if somebody's blocking your driveway, a car is parked in front of your driveway, yes, that car needs to be removed and that person needs to be cited for the inconsiderate parking of their vehicle blocking your driveway. But you don't need somebody with a badge and a gun to come there to handle that. I think that's what's at the crust of all of this. Because now there are shootings, there are robberies, there are people breaking into people's houses, people that are breaking into people's cars. Those individuals need to know and believe that they're going to get caught, that they're going to get apprehended. So if I'm out here sitting at an accident scene for 2 hours, or, you know, a water main break for 8 hours, or a down power line for 6 hours. I mean, that's 24 hours that I could just circle this one block where we've had a number of car break-ins. And yep. I can prevent you from being a victim of a crime, but nope, I'm sitting out here doing these other things that don't need a gun and a badge. And I need a gun and a badge to try to catch the person that's breaking into your house. I need that. I need that person. I don't believe a civilian could do that or should be asked to do that.
So this is where we agreed the most. This is also the point where Steve only agreed that this one thing police should always do. So Steve was the only time he agreed with all four of us on what police should always do was respond to shots fired. And then at least three of us, why it may not be all the same, three of us agreed we had the violent crime investigations broken out, but we at least agreed in some shape, form, or fashion that homicide, non-fatal shootings, assaults, and robberies should definitely be handled by police. So Rodney, that's to your point of like, there's an injury, a crime has been committed, I may have to arrest somebody, quite honestly, pull my weapon on that person. That's what we definitely, consistently all agreed that police should always do over here.
Here's why I disagree. And let me make this distinction.
Disagree to what point?
The investigatory aspects of what you just talked about. Not the apprehension, okay. but the investigation.
Steve, if I'm investigating you, if you're the shooter, and I need to be in your environment to investigate it, I don't believe that anyone could just come in, because you never know when you're going to run across you, who's the shooter, if I'm investigating. Because part of that is speaking to you about the crime that I believe that you may have been involved in. And I would not want someone going out to your house, knowing that, you know, I'm investigating you for a shooting, asking you questions, and not be able to provide a level of protection to that individual conducting that investigation.
If I feel during the course of the investigation at any time that I could be in danger, if I'm going to encounter that suspect, that's a little bit different. But if I'm sitting in the office and I'm going over evidence and I'm looking at different pieces of paper and I'm interviewing different people, sometimes, you know, someone who's especially trained to do that might actually do a better job. Now, if it comes time to a point where you need to go and confront your prime suspect, yeah, you bring somebody along who is armed. But 80% of the time while you're conducting that investigation, you're not encountering that suspect. You're doing a whole lot of other different things.
Yeah, but you're encountering an element of, you know, if you look at, you know, non-fatal shooter, even the victim, Steve, in these and majority of these non-fatal shootings, they're a victim because they may have shot someone and somebody's retaliating against them. So you have a lot of back and forth. And if you look at the investigators that are investigating homicides and investigating shootings, those can't be investigated from the office. Harold has overseen, you know, homicide investigators. I don't think that you can investigate those type of cases just looking through records and such. You got to go out into those neighborhoods, those same neighborhoods that we feel are most prone to these type of incidents. I'm kind of scared to go into some of them neighborhoods, you know, even with a badge and a gun, you know?
Well, you know, but sometimes, though, it's the person who's not armed, who is out there, who often is in a better position to get the information. You know, the minute you show up in a uniform or show up armed, then sometimes if you want the information about a homicide or attempted homicide or whatever, sometimes the lighter touch works. Yeah. So maybe you need a combination.
I think you could have people that are trained interviewers that if you brought somebody in to interview, whether it's a suspect or a witness, that the interviewer could work with the actual the gun carrying detective, but that person is skilled to do that, and then skilled to write it or build the synopsis in partnership. I think would work, but I think it would have to be a two person team. But if you think about that, now you're really getting specialized, and you have the need for fewer homicide detectives at that point because you have that support. You know, the problem with what we had, and I ran, three squads of eight with a sergeant, Rodney, and then we had one office assistant for all those people. And all she did was just try to keep up with everybody else. But, you know, if you had people that were trained to actually participate with the homicide detective in some aspects of it, and again, stayed in the office and did what they had to do, put the case together, whatever it is.
Right. Connect the dots.
You could free up some time, but it would have to be working with a detective, I think.
A perfect example of that are your victim advocates.
There you go.
Victim advocates play a big role and a similar role to what you're talking about, Steve, where they're communicating with victims, families that have information. You know, I've created two homicide support groups, and they've done more to identify witnesses, identify suspects, that now you can share that information with investigators, you know, who may not be able to get that information themselves. It keeps families, and the same way we do it for sexual assault, we do it for domestic violence, we're now doing it for homicides. I think we can do it for non-fatal shootings as well, where you have a civilian, and all of those are civilians, mm-hmm. that have the ability to coordinate, to provide follow-ups. A great deal of an investigator's time is providing follow-ups to the victim. This is where I am with the case. This is, you know, how the case is progressing. This is when we go to court. This is what's going to happen when we go to court. Taking a lot of that off of the shoulders of an investigator and allowing someone else to perform those quasi-administrative type of functions, again, I think provides more opportunities for you to put your feet on the ground out there in the community investigating those cases than trying to do it from in the office. If I got 15 shootings and I got to call 15 witnesses every 2 weeks to give them an update, then, I'm spending far too much time.
Yeah, and somebody else can do that.
Yes, yes. From that perspective, you're correct, Steve.
Okay.
All right, other than the traffic things that we said police should never do, there is some additional nevers that we all agreed on the right-hand side of your screen there. Most of those, with the exception of shoplifting coming in here as a crime, most of them are either supportive roles and or administrative type of aspects. So purchasing, grant writing, a records management of just overall functioning, and then the crime scene activities. I'm guessing all of us agreed on this because of just the certifications and kind of qualifications needed for crime scene techs to have, even if they are sworn, they're required to have a different certification as well as schooling to kind of handle evidence and lab processing and things like that in an appropriate way.
Yeah, when we talk about crime scene search, you know, I think when they finally went to civilians, I think the quality of work got much better because, you know, now you're talking about a profession,
right.
and not based on an officer being a crime scene search today and tomorrow he or she's a school resource officer or a detective. You're not guaranteed because, you know, you can invest in the training to be a crime scene search and they could leave tomorrow within your own organization. But professionalizing that role of crime scene search and making it a civilian, now someone comes into it as a career. And, you know, again, when you look at shoplifting, Jessica, I believe, again, you're talking about people and organizations, you know, you can protect your own. You're a multi- whatever company that, you know, if you look at the Walmarts and the Targets, I'm not talking about your mom and pop store. Somebody comes in and snatches, you know, a bumper of beer or something like that. You know, yeah, we But these big chains, they can handle that themselves. And that's where the bulk of those calls come from.
Yep.
You know, our highest grossing calls for service were Walmarts. People stealing from shoplifting for Walmart. Well, hire off-duty police officers and not only hire them, but let them do all the work themselves. Don't catch somebody, then call me to come and arrest the person or transport the person. Right. Now I got to go to court for it. No, you handle it yourself.
Yeah. That goes in the other crimes that it's like, so chances are, for whatever reason, they're shoplifting, they're going to continue to shoplift.
Yeah.
If it's not today, it's some other day later on this week. So the goal is to recover the property and kind of recoup any type of loss, but not necessarily like you're going to stop them from shoplifting, because the motivations for that behavior is totally different. Similar to the frauds with the car insurance and stuff. It's like, you're not going to stop them, but you are going to try to recoup and make it wildly inconvenient for them to continue to do it.
If they didn't call you, what would they do? How would they handle that?
Who?
Walmart.
Walmart would have their own security personnel that are equipped and trained to handle those cases.
So when they catch them, what do they do with them?
Steve, most of these places, they have their own jails and holding facilities right inside the store.
And if they spent more time and effort hardening their target, not the target store, but doing target hardening, making it harder for people to steal and calling them out, because the cameras in these stores are unbelievable.
Yeah.
When they see somebody start to conceal something, they just need to go up and say, put it back.
Put it back.
Talk about restorative justice. Hey, look, put it back. And now you need to leave and don't come back. And, you know, when you call people out like that, it's sort of like the teacher in school. Sooner or later, they're going to go, well, I'm not welcome here. They're actually recognizing that I'm stealing and they're not going to let me go. And that's what the stores are saying now to their people. Don't get in their way. Well, why not have a couple of big guys walk up and say, put it back? You know, take that out from under your shirt, put it back, you know?
They're trying to avoid the liability of confronting people, but yet they want the police to assume the liability of confronting people.
Right.
There's something wrong with that.
Yep. We're doing their work.
We talked about that on a prior session of like, if the expectation that the police are always supposed to show up to give this stance and this force, then why are you so shocked if we constantly have use of forces? You put us into that position, knowing that there's going to be conflict. And then where do we go from here? Yeah.
But part of it is the stupid laws that are written in the states that say they haven't stolen until they break the plane of the store, that it's not shoplifting until they leave the store. That's bull. And if it's my store and I catch somebody concealing something, I'll do what I want. It's my store. I could go up and tell them to put it back, but they just don't have the courage to do that. That's the problem. We don't want to offend anybody. We don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, and we don't want to get sued. Well, you're going to get sued anyway. So just go ahead and step up, put your big boy pants on, and quit calling the police.
Well, at least three of us in some way, shape, or form kind of agreed that crime analysis, budgeting, and public information sharing should also not be done.
Who was the fourth person that didn't agree with that, Jessica?
Oh, no. Let me look.
Was that Steve Rickman?
No, it wasn't me.
That weren't none of me.
Oh, no.
I would think that all four of us would agree.
Oh, absolutely.
There was one that I was very confused that we all did not agree on.
No, I definitely agree that you don't need sworn officers for crime analysis, budgeting, and public information sharing.
Was that one that I forgot to answer?
That's what I'm looking right now. Here is who said crime analysis sometimes was Steve Rickman.
See? Why? Why Steve Rickman?
And budgeting, Rickman also answered sometimes.
Why? I don't know why. I must have been confused.
Why Steve Rickman?
I had no answer. I must have been confused when I answered that.
And then I was the one who answered sometimes for public information sharing. And I think at this point, the information sharing was, as you get further down the list, you start to think through these things, is that like on one hand, having an officer share that information in some circumstances, and this might just be a bad categorization on my end, is that if you're talking a PIO, like a public information officer, then like it makes sense to have like a media trained person to go and do that.
Right.
But for other information sharing, I think like the relationship building, it could also sometimes be an officer.
We had a public information office that kind of handled inquiries and things like that. But when it came to, you know, you had a homicide or a robbery, PIO wasn't the person. I wanted the person that was responsible for that area face to be on TV so that people knew that this is the person that's ultimately responsible for this area and what's happened in that area. So that's who was there. And then if you were to look at, you know, even New York, who has a civilian person that oversees public information, but they still have sworn officers that are a part of that cadre that, you know, give crime tips and things of that nature. But I think from a leadership perspective, I think that should be a civilian job.
You don't need a gun or badge to do any of those things.
I agree with you. I'm not going to argue that.
Yeah, and I will, even though I perhaps am also in this category, since I used to be a cop and I still other, I don't know, I've never held a crime analysis position, but I analyze the shit out of some crime all the time. but I've seen very few officers really be able to transition into the professional world of crime analysis. Although I have seen very good investigators bridge the gap between the civilians. So we were talking earlier of like, these violent crime investigations that like you need a case manager and victim advocate that's doing all the victim follow-up or case updates or court expectations. You probably need some crime scene folks to handle all the evidence and processing and lab results and all of that stuff to put together for prosecution. I think you need a crime analyst person that helps drive some of that to say, it's often those homicides or non-fatal shootings are often connected because of retaliatory person-based things. And sometimes your investigators are really good at noticing those trends. And sometimes it really takes somebody crunching through people or place-based data to recognize all those pieces. So, yeah.
You know, Jessica, in that vein, I believe that crime analysts should always have unfettered access to sworn personnel, that they should be able to ask those questions that can trigger those thoughts and those responses from sworn personnel. So, you know, that's why I think that, yes, they are centralized, but they have decentralized responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Like these are your two districts. So you're required to go out there, meet with the officers that work in this district so you can learn the patterns and you can learn their gut feelings. It's kind of hard for an analyst that's kind of just looking at numbers to really understand what that gut feeling is out there in some of these communities that officers have. That's real. Gut feelings are real.
Yeah.
So, you know, how do you obtain that knowledge?
I don't know if we'll talk about it on Thursday with the SBI group for Salisbury, but right, like we've got a very solid list of persistent folks. There's clear profiles of, you know, juveniles that are entering into criminal activity. Like we see that kind of life course kind of theory and action. They just had a really major shooting there in their community college gym that was 2 17-year-olds. They ended up hitting a 13-year-old and a 14-year-old, unfortunately, last week. So it's like we see this kind of person-based analysis to do that. And there was dots that weren't necessarily connected by the officers. And then there was the gut feelings that the analyst or even I, just from looking at all their data, I'm like, I can tell you something's happening here, but it really takes that investigator in the room of like, oh yeah, that's Mimi's kid. And it's like, oh. And I'm like, I know it's there because I've been in that investigator's seat to know that there's that gut feeling or there's like some kind of other, but I'm like, that doesn't get written into a report, which means it doesn't get analyzed on the analyst side. So unless I have a clear distinction that Jessica is related to Harold, because we live at 123 Main Street, and it's never that clear, it really does take the kind of intelligence that officers have from being boots on the ground to augment that aspect for sure.
Yeah, that officer tell you that Rodney and Harold is always seen riding in the car together, where analysts may have something on Rodney and something on Harold, yep. but not able to bring the two of us together, you know, to kind of close that gap.
Yeah. Well, we're almost at our time today, fellas, but this is where we were starting to enter the matrix of like, where were we a little wishy-washy? This is the interesting part, and we can probably pick up from here because this is where we started to see the most separation of like, right, like again, Harold and Rodney not always sticking together, or Jessica and Steve or whatever, not sticking together. We kind of saw ourselves around some of these kind of trauma or empathy-based events, right? And I think we're probably all similar in this sense of thinking about how does this impact the community, the people, having those tough conversations with moms, dads, you know, having to notify about death scenes, having to make some decisions about those mental health calls, as well as just some of those things. This is where we all kind of seem to go around the sometimes overall, but there was definitely also some kind of clear aspects for some folks on either end of always or obviously never. So this might be one of those things when we think about if patrol is not doing those traffic things, like, is there a way to kind of recreate these types of responsibilities in a different way? Because these are the volume of calls in general over those traffic accidents. But these are those kind of volume of calls that officers deal with in those calls for service. And they all kind of require an officer to have, with maybe the exception of the noise disturbance and the report writing, they all require a little bit of like kind of trauma or empathy or some other type of like in-depth knowledge about some things that maybe officers aren't getting in training.
Hey, Jessica, I'm really curious of why Steve Rickman says that police should never be involved in school monitoring.
I know, yeah. I wrote my entire dissertation on this one. So I was like, oh, we're gonna have to discuss.
Come on, break that down for me, Steve.
Well,
you know, they don't have to be armed. They can be civilians. They can wear some kind of special uniform. But do they really need to come? Do you really need a gun and a badge to do that? You can be a part of the police department, and you can even wear a uniform. But do you really need to be a sworn officer to do that?
I hear you, but why do they have police doing it now? What was the rationale behind having sworn officers, the SROs?
Well, I think many, many years ago, they were there, you know, they were, part of their function was an enforcement function. And then they also wanted to, the whole officer-friendly concept where you can put a friendly police face in these schools where these kids can develop different perceptions of police officers. But what we're doing now, we're taking these officers and we're training them to be counselors, we're training them to be teachers, we train them to do all these other functions. And most of them, you have some who are capable of doing that, but many are not comfortable in that role. But you can find people who are part of the department who can even wear a uniform, but they don't need to be armed. They don't need to be sworn personnel or armed personnel to do most of those functions. And if you need an enforcement function, well, you know, that's what you have patrols that patrol, you know, the patrol of the area, the beach where those schools are located. You can get a patrol car there in 5 minutes if you need an enforcement function.
Okay. All right.
I got a question. Rodney, alarm calls?
Alarm calls? Yeah, what do you need police officers to deal with alarm calls for? Come on.
The only thing I could think of is that you were thinking
always.
Like, is it always responding because they're not home or they are home or it's urgent? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, we have it on that one.
I'm gonna have to bite the bullet on that one, and because I really can't come up with a plausible reason for saying that we always should respond to, because I'm one of the ones that we really shouldn't respond to, because with 90% of them being false alarms,
right,
we shouldn't be responding to any of them. So I'll fall on that sword. but then now Jessica and Steve, Harold and I would have to put back to you about not responding to suicides, the death.
This was a hard one for me. I'll let Steve go first, though.
You're going to know until you're there.
Right. You don't know until you're there. Okay. Yeah. Well, I concede that point.
So
if you get a call for service and says, hey, I'm getting ready to kill myself, should a police officer respond to that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why?
Because, you know, the same thing that you're talking about someone taking their life. And with that, I think when you talk about the sanctity of life, I think police have a higher calling to protect the sanctity of life, whether it's suicide, homicide, or whatever. I think we have a responsibility to protect the sanctity of life.
But are they prepared to talk that person out of it? They don't have the training to do that. If I get a call and say I'm getting ready to commit suicide, shouldn't I see a mental health specialist, someone who knows, who is trained to deal with that, who knows how to talk to that person, rather than someone with a gun and a badge again? What do you need to have a gun and a badge to deal with somebody who's about to commit suicide?
Well, I think if somebody is calling anonymously to report that, then you don't have a place to respond to. But if you have a location where someone is possibly attempting suicide, then I think you have to respond. You know, the same way if someone's standing on a bridge, you know, threatening to jump off the bridge, the police have to go.
Yeah.
Yes, you may bring other resources and so forth, but the police need to be there in order to help protect the sanctity of life.
The best protection is having somebody there who can talk the guy out of it, isn't it?
Well, you know, that's why we provide CIT training to officers.
You're giving, once again, you're trying to train officers to do something that they're not really best equipped to do.
Well, I go back to the sanctity of life, Steve, that we have a responsibility to protect life, right?
Well, what happened to the gun and the badge thing?
Well, you know, if you're committing suicide with a gun, then I don't want to send a clinician to say, hey, you know, don't shoot yourself. Okay, I won't shoot myself. I'll shoot you.
A suicidal individual is homicidal. Harold, there you had a comment and question.
There you go.
You got to remember, too, you're not just getting a 911 call that says, I'm going to commit suicide. You've got people on the phone, hopefully, in the comm center that are trying to figure out what the heck is going on. So could they triage some of this where the person says, hey, I'm going to swallow this bottle of pills and we're still going to go. But it may be that you're able to even negotiate with them or start to deal with that in the 911 call. But you're not going in there blind. Usually the dispatcher or the telecommunicator is going to say, well, how are you going to do that? Well, I'm going to shoot myself. Well, that means he's got a gun or she's got a gun. Well, I'm going to hang myself. Well, okay, well, we'll come and cut you down. But
I think when I saw suicide, I'm thinking that the person has killed themselves and that we're responding to investigate a death. That's what I initially look at. Now, if you had put suicide attempt, then, you know, we could have this conversation would be more germane. And I think some of the things that Steve has mentioned will come into play. But when I see someone that has taken their life, I think police always have to respond in order to determine whether or not it is, in fact, a suicide and not a homicide. And that's the same thing. That's the same thing about natural deaths. You know, when someone dies within their home and that's not under doctor's care, police have to respond to determine. Because, you know, they kind of serve as emissaries for medical examiners to determine whether or not the individual actually died of natural causes or suicide or homicide.
Yeah, it's a homicide until it's declared otherwise.
Right.
These were across several categories as I had them broken out in terms of like divisions or responsibilities. But this is where I was the most wishy-washy because these are high volume of calls in which officers deal with and respond to really does require officers to have different approaches, different training, whether that's through CIT or otherwise, and or really require officers to have someone else responding with them right, to help manage the situation or the case, whether it's talking to a mental health individual or a suicidal individual or other, you know, things around the issues, that this to me gets at the crux of, do we train officers to do these things or do we not? Or is it constantly a co-response model or is it a completely different response model? And I think this is where, like, I'm still undecided as an individual because I think the volume of, you know, like Rodney, to your point, like, how do you know if it's a suicide? You got to get there, right? What? Like, how do you make those notifications or how do you deal with, you know, right now, a lot of officers or a lot of agencies are dumping from their calls for service overdose calls, right? Because they're like, we're not going. It's the fire department. They've gotten, you know, Narcan or Naloxone and we're not going. It's a, you know, it's, we're not charging crime, so we shouldn't be there. And there's different opinions of those things. And I think we don't know enough about, these things look so different in different jurisdictions that to figure out, like, is it a co-response? Is it a sole response? Or is it a retraining your police force to respond? Because this is the volume of the demands of the community. So that's where I stand, is that you really have to define the role of your patrol officers differently in order for these to be appropriately responded to.
I want to go back to Rodney's badge and gun.
I got to drop off. I got to go clean some paint cans.
All right.
So we'll have to pick this up.
To pick this one up because this actually ties to the next one as well, where this is where, like, we probably have the most kind of, like, you know, wiggly room between the group here, but really perhaps can get us to the point of, you know, if this is what we're responding to, if this is what we're doing, I definitely have to talk to you guys about this report writing next time. But if these are the bulk of the community needs and the officer's response or public safety's response is about that sanctity of life, and this is what's just causing so much disruption to the sanctity of life, is there a different way that we need to be thinking about response and restructuring our patrol divisions, both civilian and sworn, to be able to handle those responses?
Yeah, I'd be interested in cities like Eugene, Oregon, which has already downloaded about 25% of their calls. I'm wondering if they have downloaded the suicide calls and the overdose calls. I'd be curious.
Yeah,
I know about, I don't know about you, Rodney. I know about 10 or 15 agencies I've talked to over the last 3 months that are like, they're dumping the mental health calls, they're dumping the overdose calls, they're dumping any suspected drug use calls. And obviously, like, the state of Washington last year, when similar to Oregon, as they now made drugs legal, that it's like, it's not even a crime. So we're not even responding from a crime perspective. But I think this is where you do see some significant changes with the legalization of drugs on police, on how that impacts police response or police outcomes. And with the exception of Eugene, Oregon, I don't know that we really have a clear answer of, is it a good or a bad thing?
Now, drug use is one thing, and I can see not responding to that, but there's nowhere that I know that where they've legalized drug sales. So I think that there's still a need to respond to drug sales, because you wouldn't expect, you know, citizens or civilian to respond to someone that's selling drugs, knowing that a great deal of individuals that sell drugs are, you know, could be gang members, could be armed to protect their drugs and their money and so forth. So drug sales, yes. Drug use, no, somebody sitting out there in a car smoking weed or whatever, you know, I don't think that, you know, we need to have police responding to those type cases.
Thanks again for listening to another episode of The Den. We'd love to hear your voice on what police should or perhaps shouldn't be performing in terms of public safety. Please take a moment to look in the show notes for a link to take a survey so that you can have a say for the future of policing. See you next time in The Den.
Thanks for listening. If you want to learn more about today's topic, IDEA Analytics, or work with them, visit their website, analyticsbyidea.com. There, you'll find their latest blog posts, case studies, and contact information. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe, rate, and review Conversations on Public Safety, The Den, on your preferred podcasting platform. See you next time.